Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
Good evening and welcome to Breaking the Silence. And here we are live from the most awesome city in the world, Houston, Texas. The sun is just going down behind my back. And as we go through the show tonight, you'll see that sun go ahead and go down past the Texas Medical Center, which is awesome here in Houston, Texas. And I work at Baylor College of Medicine, Texas Children's Hospital, on the 10th floor right behind me, about a block and a half away. And it's just great to be in such a wonderful town that has such wonderful diversity. And to be honest with you, I always joke about it, but I mean it seriously. I think Houston is just a little bit south of heaven. This is about as close as we're going to get before we get to heaven. I love it here. If you ever get an opportunity to come to Houston, come on down and holler, and maybe we can have coffee or do lunch. I'd love to be able to meet you if you're ever in the area. Love to have you. Tonight, we have a guest that I believe is just going to knock your socks off. So you may want to scotch tape him on, a little bit tired tonight. You may want to use that duct tape, keep him on. But make sure you have a pencil, a piece of paper, because I think there's going to be some wisdom here that you're going to want to remember. 888-627-6008 is the number that if you want to call in, or you can get right on the Shattered by the Darkness a Facebook page right now. My son's running it from Seattle, Washington on Facebook. And if you have a comment, you're welcome to comment right there. And you can watch us also live right there. Tomorrow, my new book comes out on the Kindle edition. So if you have an opportunity to get on, just look at it. You don't have to buy it. Just look at it. Every set of eyes does some kind of tick in their counters for Amazon. And then on August 16th, this book, which I actually have hundreds of over there in the corner, becomes on sale at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart, Target, all those different places that you can pick up books. But tomorrow, the Kindle version comes out, When Dark Clouds Come, The Roadmap to Hope. Speaking of that, I always like to start off each program with just something that is on my mind, maybe something that I'm going through this week, just something I think maybe we all need to hear. And tonight's guest may be able to underline and highlight and circle these things even greater, I'm sure greater than what I'm going to be able to explain to you. But I just want to start off tonight, and whoever's listening, I want to let you know that you're not a victim. You are an overcomer. You are a victor. You are a survivor in this adventure of what we call life. So things don't go your way. You may have been injured, hurt, abused, used, crumpled up like an old tore up rag and thrown away like trash, tossed aside. But if you're listening tonight, or tomorrow, or next week when you're listening to the repeats of this on podcast, you survived. So you are a survivor. Matter of fact, you're a champion. We made it through some of the times that we never thought that we would ever make it through. And life doesn't begin after the obstacles. Life is the obstacles. That's powerful if you really think about it. We all have our escapes, but reality in honesty is so much more beautiful. Things aren't always going to go our way. If we feel entitled to things, that's when we're going to have a bad time. And the other night I was watching, it was a special of America's Got Talent, and I happened to like that show. And it was the top 10 or 15 gold buzzer moments over the years in history of America's Got Talent. And there was a Christian singer on there, and her name was, she went by Nightbird, that had cancer while she was singing her song and told the judges that she had cancer. And she got the gold buzzer and never made it to the live shows because cancer overcame her and took her life. But she said a couple quotes the other night as I was listening, and I put it on pause and wrote down every word. And I want you to hear the words that she said. Here she was with cancer in her lungs and her liver and her kidneys. And she said, "I am so much more than the bad things that happened to me." You are too. I want you to know that you are too. After she sang the song, the audience was absolutely deathly quiet. And then they applauded the applause and everybody stood up and cheered. And during the judge's remarks, she said something else that was very powerful. And I wrote it down, put it on pause, and jotted it down. I always have a notebook there by my chair. And she said, "You can't wait until life isn't hard anymore before deciding to be happy." That is such truth. Because let's be honest, in life, nothing's promised. When that idea is honestly absorbed, every moment is celebrated and appreciated. I get lots of emails, hundreds of emails a week. And sometimes every now and then people will slam me because they heard me say something of, I always say almost, thank God for what I've gone through because it made me who I am today. My scars are absolutely beautiful. And I'll get those naysayers that always say, "No, that's so wrong. You should have never been abused." And you didn't hear what I said. I am taking what was done to me that was meant to kill me, and I've been turned into a stronger, better, more energetic, more positive person than I ever would have been if my life was squeaky clean with no obstacles at all. And I have another page and a half that I'd love to be able to share with you right now, but I want you to hear this and see if these truths and see how resounding they are with our guest tonight, Tito De La Garza III, is a longtime recovery survivor, a survivor, not a victim, a survivor of a suicide attempt, maybe more. We'll find out about that here just shortly. A restorative justice advocate, incarcerated from youth to adult. Prison became the platform that propelled him to a higher plane, to a higher level, to success. He has a BS in addiction studies. He has a master's of science in mental health. He has a master's of business administration in nonprofit management. And he is now the executive director of Recovery Support Services. And I want to let you know, it is my honor and privilege to introduce him to the world tonight and on our program to all our listeners, Tito De La Garza. Tito, are you there?
Saying unmute.
Hey, yes. How are you?
There we go. I'm good. Can't complain.
Now, you're in your car. What part of the country are you in right now, Tito?
I am in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, north side of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, right? I am actually in my car on purpose. I work part time at a boys group home as a mentor, and so that's something that I do on the weekends, something I do throughout the week. It's really not even a job. It's just an opportunity to be able to give back.
So you're actually mentoring boys, and my understanding there is one of those boys in your car right now.
Yeah, I wish I could show them, but private practices, right? But definitely, I have him in the car with me today. He was trying to get me to kind of made an agreement, like, because he thought I was gonna leave. I was like, I'll give you my word, I'm not gonna leave at the center, right? Because I just switched out with one of the other boys. And I said, well, look, I'm going to be on a radio show. So if you want to come with, we're not going to be going anywhere and doing anything. You want to come with, you can come with. And he still wanted to come. So
that's awesome. That means he wants to spend time with his mentor, which is wonderful. And I appreciate that so much. You know, Tito, tell me, you know, I just threw out a minute or two of what I have. It's probably another 5 minutes to go, but I wanted to get to you. Did any of those words strum a heartstring, or are you like, hey, wait, absolutely? Or what's your take on those thoughts that I opened up the program with?
You know, you mentioned Survivor, right? And so that resonates with me every day from the day that I came out of prison, which is now 14 years, right? So it's a revolving door of survival, but only this time it's not survival in the street life. It's more so survival as a profession. And you know, it's easy to say that, you know, I've been healed or I've been delivered or whatnot, but at the same time, it's knowing where you're healed and how you're healed and where that came from. Perspective, right? I guess what I'm trying to say is, as a survivor, surviving in the new life is like a reentry process every day, because people, places, and things can be a trigger to you. And some things can remind you of certain things. Like, because I spent so many years from youth to adult, when I go and I use the bathroom or I go use a restaurant's bathroom, the detergent that they use, I smell it, and I smell the detergent, right? And it reminds me of juvenile detention centers, or reminds me of prison, or reminds me of when I was doing work in prison, right? So it's that piece that kind of really resonated with me, was the survivor piece.
Yeah,
it's powerful. Powerful.
You know, it seems that when I read the little short bio that you sent to me, there's so many stories in between each word of your short bio that was like maybe 8 sentences. There's so many stories. And I love that you told me, and to be honest with everybody that's listening, we don't have a set of questions. Tito basically told me, hey, Greg, I'm an open book. You can ask me anything you want. And I appreciate that, because some people will get on and say, hey, wait, I don't want to go there. I don't want to go there. And I try to respect that, and I do. But to just say, hey, I'm a wide open book. You want people to learn from what you've gone through. And I think that's wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like when you go for a job and you have 6 felonies on your record, right? They're going to know about your background regardless. So you might as well just tell them, right? And then, you know, one thing I've learned in that process is I can share a little bit of my past, but definitely shed light on a lot of my future. But yeah, I mean, it's and for myself, being in recovery and then being a survivor of suicide, I think for me, when it comes to not only doing the work that I do, but also enjoying the quality of life that I have, is to embrace change, right? Like, it's so hard to embrace change, especially when it's like, because I work at nonprofits, and so sometimes they lose grants. And sometimes I do have concerns that, you know, the job where I'm at might lose their grant, and then I won't have a job. But one thing I learned of that process is as long as I don't use, I'm winning. And I think for me, that's a successor for myself. Because back in the day, man, when things didn't go right, I used. When I lost the job, I used. And when I say used, I mean like using crack cocaine, alcohol, ecstasy, acid, shrooms. I used anything and everything pretty much just to get away from that feeling, right? Only to find out that later on it was back again.
Yeah. But, Tito, yeah. When did all the drug use, alcohol use, started becoming a way of life for you? What age were you at when that started becoming something that you reached for?
Are you saying like when did it all really start, right?
Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah. So, well, in the Latino community, we celebrate Cinco de Mayo. And so it's traditional for us to drink alcohol, right? Celebration. And my mother at the time offered me a beer. And after that one beer was tequila. And then after tequila, it was just ever since that day, it just kind of excelled. I don't fault my family for that. As I know now in my undergrad degree, it kind of really showed me a whole lot. But the most important piece of this question that you're asking me is it started at age 12. And I really didn't know that it was actually wrong. You know what I mean?
Because family was doing it, right?
Right. Because the word wrong didn't even exist back then. You know what I mean? Like, even when I got locked up as a kid or even as an adult doing 30 days, 6 months in jail, it didn't seem like such a big deal. Right. But once I got clean, I started looking at my past. It was like, I don't know what in heck and San Hell thought, excuse my language, no, thought it was okay to do 30 days in a county jail and come back out and think that it was all right to do. You know, like it just, some things just didn't make sense to me. But it was a traditional piece. And then that just kind of excelled after that.
You mentioned you survived a suicide attempt. What was the prelude up to getting in that darkness of your life to where you thought the only way out was to take your life? What was you running from? What was you wanting to get away from?
So I was involved with a gang, and gang affiliation. You're required to be at certain places at certain times. And so when you're not at these certain places at certain times or in certain days, right, you get a violation. And so after so many violations and I was arrogant when I was younger because my family, they were the Incas and the Casincas. And Incas and Casincas mean like they were the leaders of this gang. So I thought it was okay because they was my family, right? But in real life, in that life, that was not okay. So unexpectedly, I would get violations. And at some point, I happened to be at my lowest. And I just didn't feel like life was worth living. And I think on that specific day, to be exact, I just thought about everything that took place in my childhood because I thought that getting involved with the gangs was what I was supposed to do. Or I thought that if I would demonstrate the disobedience that my older brother demonstrated, that I would reap the same benefits, right? Sounds a little off, right? But that's what I thought. If I did bad like my brother, then I would reap good consequences. Unfortunately, I didn't get to reap those good consequences, right? I didn't get to get away with things. I don't know, you know, that one night, I just kind of thought to myself, like, reflecting back on why I got involved with gangs was because I was bullied, right? And then what happened before then, before I was bullied? I was sexually assaulted as a kid at 7 years old.
Okay.
My lifestyle, yeah. So they, you know, it, that first attempt to suicide of suicide was to take a bunch of speed pills. Yeah.
Was that to run away from the problems or to just deaden the pain or to scream for help?
I think it was more, I believe for me, it was more of the problem.
Yeah.
That was more the problem.
Okay. I want to drill in a little bit deeper into that. So we're going to take our first commercial break. Folks, okay. If you want to get on the phone and call some people, what we're going to hear on the other side of this commercial break is even more about the push that happened in the life that caused him to want to give up, to go that mile. But then I'm also going to, we're not going to finish this program tonight until we find out what was the turning point and looking for hope towards the end of the program and how you're changing people's lives today, every day of your life. And I just love that story. But we're going to talk about that on the other side of this break. 888-627-6008. If you want to get involved, or Breaking the Shatter by the Darkness Facebook page, we'll get you there to us too. So we'll be right back after this first commercial break. Hang with us. Life, and they're simply certain will be an in-depth look at where. Finally coming very soon will be the release of my second book in the three-part trilogy, Overcoming the Darkness, The Roadmap to Hope. Now, this book will be an in-depth look at the many different facets and emotions that a person goes through when they're experiencing anxiety and trauma in their life, and they're simply searching for hope. And an exciting addition to this book will be a companion journal guide that will come along with it. Also, there's going to be something that I'm very excited about, the youth version of this book called When Dark Clouds Come, The Roadmap to Hope. And it's going to be an excellent tool and guide for teenagers dealing with stress in their lives. So stay tuned for the release date coming very, very soon for these exciting new resources. Now back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams on the BBS Radio Network. Welcome back. Looks like Tito is on the move now, so he's in traffic. Well, we have had a great first segment with Tito. If you want to get involved, 888-627-6008. And we're learning about Tito up in Wisconsin. And Tito, we came in contact with each other from Dr. Gale's class. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And Dr. Gale is one of our frequent guests here on the program, where I'm sure she's listening tonight. So good evening, Dr. Gale. And I love her class because we get to just talk really down and raw with social workers that are looking for CMEs or additional education, another course, learning how to handle different types of situations that they counsel with. And I just love getting to talk to her and the class, because I get to meet wonderful people like our guest tonight, Tito. So Tito, you mentioned, and you just casually mentioned, and I don't want to go any deeper than you want to, but you did mention that at 7 years old, you were sexually assaulted. Do you think prior to that, of course, at 7 years old, you knew it was something wrong, but did that start a spiral of events in your gray matter up here that started you looking at things differently than what you would have if you hadn't been?
No.
Okay.
I believe that I knew I was different.
In what right? way, Tito?
So, like, for example, today, I identify as being a part of the LGBT community.
Okay.
Right? So as a young boy, before being sexually molested, I already knew for myself that I was different. I didn't know what that different was, but I knew that at 7 years old, I liked girls and boys at 7 years old, my age, right? So when the assault did happen, it really propelled into a promiscuous behavior of thinking that it was okay to do things with family members my age. So incest in the family was introduced to me at a young age. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, no, you're fine. I'm just taking it all in. So incest was just part of family life?
Yes, incest was a part of family life all the way until the age I was 18. I did not know that it was wrong until the gang that I was in brought it to my attention, right? So it was a really dysfunctional upbringing. It was almost like the gang life was a place of restoration, but also a place of discipline, right? And I would have expected my family to tell me that it was wrong, but I never got that opportunity from my family to be told that what was happening was wrong, because my family taught that it was right and it was okay.
So basically you didn't know any different. That was just the way of life, and everybody in the family was in that same cycle?
I wouldn't say everybody. I would say a portion, a high portion of kids my age at that time were involved. So, with each other, right? It wasn't like, I know my uncle molested me, right? There's a little blur of, I can't really pinpoint for certain if it was my dad, but there were things that did happen that when I was in therapy that I reflected on and I questioned it, you know, right? And there were times that I felt like, even now being in recovery, that I still question, did my dad do something to me, right? And so, because I never really received an answer for it, I was uncertain of it being appropriate to do so.
So how does the family respond now that you are on the other side of this storm and these storms of your life, and you're talking about it now live to people around the world and sharing that? Has there been an acceptance? Has there been a remorse? Or have you been ostracized? How's the family dealing with your recovery and revealing to people that this is what's happened to you, even though they knew it?
I think for me, honestly, when it comes to embracing my recovery, they didn't really accept their responsibility, right? And that didn't even happen until like 2010. When I came out of prison in 2009, for about a good 2.5-3 years, my mother and my little brothers were not accepting of me. So when I finally had the opportunity to speak to my mother, she had asked some questions in terms of, why is it that I don't come around a lot? And so when I gave her my response to that, and my response was, there's been a lot of experiences that I've had in my addiction that when I was in treatment in prison, a lot of those questions came to fruition and I wanted to know what happened. And each time I tried to engage you in a question or a conversation of my upcoming, you always told me that that was the past and that I should leave it alone. And so if we weren't able to establish or reconnect or rekindle us as a mother and son relationship, then we weren't really going to go very far. And so one day I took her out to eat, and I was able to address and share what that experience was like. It didn't go very well. And it went well for me. It didn't go very well for her. And so when I was able to reveal to her about what I experienced, she said that she didn't know. And so I couldn't challenge that, because maybe she just didn't know, right? Mm-hmm. But there was a part of me that felt that I wished that she would have known something, right? meaning in a sense of taking accountability for what did take place. And in that moment, I was able to share that it wasn't her fault that they gave me alcohol at 12, and that it wasn't her fault for a lot of different things, right? But what I really wanted to hear from her was to take responsibility for allowing me to continue to be a bad kid. Like, and again, I don't fault my mother by all means. Like, I love her. You know what I mean? We have a relationship now. I guess there were just some things I wanted her to admit to, like giving me my first drink or giving me my first hit or, you know, allowing me to sell drugs out the house or just, you know, I wanted her to say, you know what, mijo, there are some things that happened growing up that I shouldn't have done. And I really messed up and I shouldn't have done that. I didn't realize that that was causing you to continue on. But again, I got to take responsibility too, because at a young age, I was very manipulative.
Yeah.
And so, go ahead.
How much does the Hispanic culture play into the way family deals with this type of secrets in their life? I know each culture has a complete different approach to when things happen within these walls, you know. I know what we did in Southern Illinois. What happens in this house stays in this house, and we don't tell anybody. And we did it. I just wonder, how does the Hispanic culture deal with these type of secrets and these type of pains?
That's actually what does happen. That is exactly what happens. And I mean, it's encouraged not to tell or else. Right. And then the crazy thing about that is even though I was experiencing the physical, the mental, the emotional, and the sexual abuse, I didn't even want to tell.
Right.
You know what I mean? Not because what happened in the house stayed in the house, but more so I didn't want to be away from my mom or my dad. I didn't want to be around or be away from my abuser. You know? Yeah. Crazy, but yeah.
So I understand that thought, because sometimes it's more comfortable being in a place where you know what's going to happen instead of exposing, telling, and then not knowing what the future is going to hold at your next place if somebody comes in and yanks you out. It could be, you know, there's a comfort zone there. So I understand that. When you talk about in your lifeline, prison, incarceration, overnight, 6 days, 30 days, 6 months, and then it becomes longevity. Tell me about how that process worked and what was that last stint in, and how long was you in for your longest time?
In prison?
Yes.
2 years, 8 months.
And what was that for?
That was for possession with intent to deliver crack cocaine, obstructing an officer, and 4 counts of driving without owner's consent. When I say 4 counts, I mean, like, I was on probation as an adult, and I never got off paper. It happened, and I'm laughing about it because now when I look back at my craziness and my addiction and, you know, until this day, I'm constantly resubmitting my paperwork to DSPS for licensing. And each time I go over my case, I notice, like, man, you were really messed up, you know? So it's just funny how messed up I was. That's all.
Well, so how did, while you were in prison, is that when the light bulb started going on in your life of saying, hey, wait, I want to make a difference. I want to help other people. I want to start studying, because you have more degrees than many people in this world. And congratulations and accolades for that. But when did that all become, hey, wait, I have to make a difference. I have to change, or this is going to kill me.
You know what it took for me? Yeah. Honestly, Pastor Jackson.
Pastor Jackson.
Yeah, Pastor Jackson. He, see, when I was in prison, I was like praying to God and asking God to take away my sexual pleasure desires and all that stuff. I wanted to be made brand new, and I wanted all this and all this great, good, wonderful stuff, right? And so, even to the point when I was on the praise and worship team, I'm up there and I'm praising God, right? But there's a part of me that was crying out to God and asking God to help me with me, right? Pastor Jackson one day pulled me to a side. He said, so we had two pastors, right? We had one non-denominational, the other one was Baptist, or Pentecostal and Baptist, right? And so anyway, Bishop Jackson said to me, there's five things that I'm going to need from you, Teodolo. Well, first he invited me to come down to the chapel, and I came down to the chapel, and I'm like, oh, great. I know what's going to happen. He's going to tell me I can't be on the worship team and this, this, and this, and whatever, right? All these assumptions. I get there. He asked me to sit down. I sit down. He pulls out the Bible, right? And then there goes my other assumption. Like, oh, here we go. He's going to, you know. But what he said to me was he pointed out a scripture, and I can't remember what it was, but it was about God's unconditional love. And it was at that moment, at that day, that time, that experience, he pointed out that there was five things that God gave to him to give to me.
Five
and he
things.
Said, he said, one of those things is to accept your past and then accept yourself. Then he said, learn to love myself and learn to love my past. He said, learn to forgive myself and to forgive my past. And then I could step into the future with discipline. And then the fifth one was pretty much to repeat back again, evaluating of where I was at, of what I accepted and what I didn't accept, and find my resolution with God to get acceptance. And I thought to myself, like, wow, like, that was powerful, right? So the biggest thing for me when I went back to my unit that evening, it just felt like, you know what? I didn't have to fight me anymore. It almost seemed like an approval from God was sent to me to give to me to tell me that I didn't have to fight with myself anymore as long as I applied these things, right? But applying those steps meant that I had to accept the physical, the mental, the emotional, and the sexual abuse. I had to accept the people that inflicted me. I had to accept every part, every action. He worked with me on it. That's the, you know, it wasn't just a five-step thing, right? I write down the acceptance, and he would challenge me to find some more acceptance in other areas. And so accepting those experiences that happened, but now it wasn't just accepting those experiences that happened to me. It was accepting me, how God sees me. That was the hardest piece to do.
Isn't that amazing? Because I talk about this all the time, every week with somebody, that half of the battle that we have with the world is with ourselves. Yep. And that acceptance of who we are, and that acceptance of even how could someone love me? Because I know what I'm like. I know what I've gone through. I know what
right.
I was, you know, supposedly thrown away as. But when we yep. recognize the power of God's unconditional love, it's life-changing, right?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow. Tell you what, we're going to take our last break. On the other side of this, I want to continue drilling in this because this is good stuff. And then I really want to find out, how did you start going into the recovery mode, learning more about it? And we want to make sure you have all the time in the world to offer hope to everybody that might be on the edge right now, tonight, and needs to hear that word straight from you, Tito. So on the other side of this break, keep with us, and we'll talk more with Tito. And 888-627-6008 if you want to get involved, you have a question or a comment. We'll be right back. Don't leave us on this last segment. You'll want to hang with us.
From HCI Publishing, that brought you the international bestsellers, A Child Called It, and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years, and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
Welcome back to our last segment, and we're with Tito, and it's getting dark there too, right, Tito? The sun's going down behind me, and these five things that Pastor Jackson told you, the third one about forgiveness. How big is forgiveness in this journey with you?
Ask that one more time.
How big is that one step? I believe it's the third step that you gave me of his five steps, was to learn to forgive. How big was that for you?
Whew, that was huge. I had to forgive. I had to first forgive the people that caused the sexual abuse in the family. And so not only did I have to forgive them, I had to forgive the people that were a part of it that knew about it and didn't say, right? Mm-hmm. But when it also came to forgiving myself,
yes,
that was the hardest. That was hard. It took a long time. It took a lot of Bishop Jackson to point out scripture. And I thought he was going to give up on me, but he didn't, you know what I mean? I think what that did for me is that really showed me that somebody cared. It wasn't even about the whole pastor or anything of that nature. It was the fact that another human being was willing to work with me and walk me through forgiveness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you understood the fullness and the depth and width of unconditional love from God, did that allow your heart to expand to try to do the same for others?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It does something to you.
So when you started hearing these things, is that when you decided, hey, wait, you know, when did the, I want to become a recovery specialist, I want to get educated in all of these things, I want to help other people. When did that enter into the picture, Tito?
When I was in prison, I wanted to do volunteer work in prison. I don't know where that came from. And maybe that came from when I was working in the chapel. I took a life skills class in prison. And so that's where the idea came from. Sergeant McLaughlin had, I put in a request to my social worker asking if I could do some volunteer work upstairs in the treatment center. You know, I don't have a college degree. I'm still thinking like, God gonna make a way some way, somehow. I'm gonna give it a shot anyway and see what happens. Well, they sent me a slip back that said that they don't allow people to do volunteer work in the treatment center up there. But I did get a slip from Mary McLaughlin, Sergeant Mary McLaughlin. And she requested me that day to come to her unit or to her office. And I thought, great, now I'm in trouble because I asked to do some volunteer work. I shouldn't have said nothing. And she said, as soon as I knocked on the door and I came in, she asked me to have a seat. She's like, Mr. De La Garza, you're not in trouble. She said, I got your slip. Sergeant Litke gave me your slip. And I just wanted to know if you would be interested in being a part of our Scared Straight program.
Oh.
Yes. And that's how that started. I didn't know what a Scared Straight program was. I asked her at that moment, like, what does that all include? You know, what do I need to do? I don't have my high school diploma yet. And, you know, I just kind of gave her the rundown with that. And I talked about all the bad things that I did. And I tried to take, you know, it's almost like I was trying to it's kind of like I was talking bad about myself to get her to not want me. But then at the end of the conversation, she said I would be a perfect fit. So I'm like, great. Well, let's go. Right. So that's how it all started, doing Scared Straight programs at Oak Hill Correctional Institute. Then I got into school and I earned my HSCD in prison. I learned how to read and write from like third grade. There was a 5.09 program that I was in, and there was a reason for that. You know, I was that one kid who rode that yellow bus, right? People, as they call it, the slow bus, right? And I had a learning disability. So growing up, I struggled with reading and writing. And I learned based off of repetition. And so long story short, I enrolled into that program, got my HSCD, attended. I took advantage of what the prison had to offer. And when I got released back into the community in 2009, I went through a program called CSEP, which is another community-based organization for people on parole. And wow, now that I'm hearing myself talk about this, it's really interesting because then I met Patty Pandowski, who was the clinical director, and she had asked me, you know, what I wanted to do with my life. No one ever asked me that coming out of prison, not even my probation officer, right? But anyway, that's where my journey started, was at a human service technician at Matt Talbot Residential Treatment Center here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Unbelievable. Then from getting your learning to read and write, getting your high school degree, getting college degrees one after another after another.
Yeah. And then what really also really, really propelled me to want to change was the fact that when I was in prison, after I accepted myself and worked through all that stuff, and Pastor and Bishop Jackson told me that it was going to be an ongoing piece. It wasn't just work on it now and work on it later, it was going to be an ongoing journey, right? I lost my train of thought.
That's okay.
Son of a biscuit.
Well, I was just mentioning you got degree after degree after degree, and then that sparked something.
Yeah, so I had the opportunity to come out of prison early, right? But I knew that if I would have got into that earn release program, I wouldn't have been able to accomplish what I, or you know,
oh, no,
accomplish
wait a minute.
What I started.
You mean you stayed in prison longer?
Yeah.
Because you were unbelievable.
Yeah. I stayed back. So when I spoke to Sergeant Litke, I had said, I don't want to go to the earn release program because I just got into the 509 program. And that's the thing too. When I was fighting to get it, when I say fighting, I mean like I had to keep writing in slips about the 509 program. And what took place was when I started into my HSCD program, they weren't just going to allow me to go into the 509 program because there were certain requirements and I didn't meet the requirements. And so I went back to my unit and I just talked to God, man. And I just let it out. Like, look, if you're going to use me, there's some things I'm going to need. And I need to be into the 509 program. And I want the parole to not like, what's that word? Discipline me because I said no, I don't want to get out early. You know, right. I don't know. Prison is just really, really different. It's another world. You know what I mean? You say no to what's going to be helpful for you, and to them, it's like the bad thing, and it's just really confusing. So anyway, I got that slip, and I was accepted one day before my parole, right? One day before my parole, I got accepted into the 509 program, right? But it wasn't just trial and error in terms of, like, submitting my paperwork. I had to evaluate my own scores for myself to determine and prove to the board of directors in the education department of when I first started 6 months ago, where I'm at 9 months ago, and evaluating my, I had to do that. Not the staff, not the school, not anybody. And the reason for that was because I wanted to show that I'm not just making this up, that I struggle with reading and writing. I wanted to show that my scores were starting off at 33, 36, 65, down to 60, down to 48, you know. Anyway, at some point, they allowed me into the 509 program. I went to my parole hearing, and I thought they were going to, like, immediately be okay with it, but they wanted to know why. I was like, great, here we go again. They're probably not going to let me stay because of this, and I gave them my reason why. And my reason why was I was afraid that if I got out early, I would recommit and not get my HSCD.
Wow.
They went back into their office. They came back to the front desk, and they said they would honor and grant me the opportunity to stay back and earn my HSCD.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Hey, well, we only got about a minute or two left. I want to get to this because this is such an unbelievably inspirational story, Tito. For people that you are helping now in the recovery, but maybe even because my heart's for children, for the young boy that's in the seat of your car right now that you're mentoring, what do you say to them? And we only have a real short period of time now. What do you say to them about what and how precious life is? What's your encouragement to them? Where's the hope for them as you mentor these kids?
I think the biggest piece when you work with at-risk youth or youth who have behavioral experiences or behavioral challenges, there's a cognitive behavioral therapy model that I use, which allows you to explore the thoughts, attitudes, and beliefs, right? And then there's that person-centered theory process or therapy process where you allow the youth to express their experiences as they see fit without changing the subject, right? And so then I go in with motivational interviewing, asking those thought-provoking questions and not dictating their answers to make them fit what I think they should be doing. What I do is I ask them those questions, whatever it may be, right? And then I empower them on the positive responses that they give back to me. I don't take from their experience in terms of their answers and neglect what they say as invalid. In fact, what I do is I ask, can I challenge this question with you? Are you okay with exploring this question? Because I think if we explore it, we can see the good, we can see the bad. So what I do is I help broaden their perspectives because they don't know too much, right? They know a lot of other things. But in this specific area with coping healthy-wise, they don't know what that is. And it's not their fault. And I don't personalize that either. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's more so empowering their strengths. And helping them to identify their trauma and then using their trauma to be their voice to advocate for themselves.
Fantastic.
That's what I do.
Tito, I cannot thank you enough for being on the program. I would love to just go ahead and publicly invite you to come back because I didn't even get to the tip of the iceberg of where I wanted this to go. So I'd love to have you come back on the program, and I want to talk more about your recovery and the work that you actually do now in those units. And talk more in depth with that if we could. So thank you so much for being on the program tonight, Tito. God bless you. I appreciate it.
No problem. Anytime. Let me know.
Thank you. As we always do, we always end the program every week. And Tito's story was just so powerful. And I wish we had more time to be able to put another half hour into it to get even more about how if you just find out maybe why you were created and the purpose that you have. And when we discover that it's not just about survival, it's about triumphing over all of those things and becoming the champion that you are. And I always want to let you know, as we close out, that no matter what you've gone through, no matter what you're going to go through, Tito was a perfect example tonight. Folks, there's always hope. Hang on to that and remember, you are a champion. God bless
one
you.
Thing. Have a great Can I say one thing?
Real quick, Tito, yep. Yeah.
Okay, one last thing I wanted to say is I'm really grateful for working at the Milwaukee LGBT Center, because if it wasn't for them, I would not be able to be where I'm at today. That's
there
all
you
I
go.
Have. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you for sharing that. God bless you. Join us right here next week for another edition of Breaking the Silence. God bless. Have a great week.
You got it.
Thanks, Tito.
You got it.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1. For the next episode of Breaking the Silence.